Would you like to come and field some more questions? Thank you again for your talk. I sort of felt, you know, the light had dimmed actually when you got up to start speaking. You know, the sun had gone behind the clouds just to get us right there where we needed to hear. Any questions that people have? Yes. Yeah, great question. So the question is, it seems that Australia in particular has forgotten its creator. Ecclesiastes, the teacher, tells us to remember our creator, and we've kind of as a nation, as a society, sort of forgotten. And then remember our creator in the days of your youth, and particularly our young people have forgotten. So any thoughts on what we can do to kind of, I guess, help our society, but particularly our young people, heed the teacher's advice?
Thank you. Yes, certainly it's a very interesting point. Let me start with this observation, which is, for whatever it's worth and whatever it means, in the census, it is still the case that 60 to 70% of people tick the box saying that they're Christians, and another 10 to 20% of people tick other religious boxes, and so the so-called nuns, that's not N-U-N-S, that's N-O-N-E-S, right, the nuns, the no religion, is actually still, I think it's like 17% or something. So there's still actually a very small percentage of people, well, not very small, a significant but nonetheless small minority of people who, as I say, whatever it means, whatever it counts for, will indicate that they are not religious, in other words, don't believe in God, and that still the majority, if not the significant majority of people in this country, tick the box saying they believe in God. I'll give you another one. A McCrindle research, so you may have heard of a social researcher called Hugh Mackay. His sort of successor is a guy called Mark McCrindle. He's a Christian man, straightforward, Bible-believing Christian bloke. And he does social research. They did a very sizable social research program and came up with results that around 50% of the population of Australia still believe most of the Christian doctrines. They believe that there is a God. They believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. They believe that he died on the cross. A slightly smaller percentage believe that he rose again from the dead. And a fair percentage of people believe in heaven, whatever that means, and hell. Now, as I say, I don't want to put too much emphasis or weight on that, but nor do I want to ignore that if you actually go around and ask a straightforward question like, do you believe in God? Still, most people do believe in God. We know that they don't have saving faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, right? So there's a big gap between those two things. One of the things that I think is interesting, and this is where I was getting, I've tried to sort of sprinkle in each of the talks some reflection on how we might take the perspective of Ecclesiastes and use it in our evangelism, in our witness to Jesus Christ. And I just wonder whether one of the ways in which we might have made things harder for ourselves in evangelism or harder for other people is that we have emphasized what's wrong about what they believed instead of working with what's right about what they believed. That we have highlighted the negative rather than sought to work with the positive. And in particular, we live in a post-Christian world, which is very different from a Christian world or a pre-Christian world. Okay? And here's how the post-Christian world differs. It differs in two ways. One, it's still basically shaped at some level by our Christian moral heritage. Now, I know it's not shaped by much of our Christian moral heritage, but it still is shaped by some, and you see that in the way that there is deep community outrage at things like child abuse and so on. That's all in that they get that from us, from Christians. In fact, so much so that they are shaped by our Christian moral heritage that they think Christianity is morality and morality is Christianity. They think that Christianity is morality and morality is Christianity, which is why most people in Australia still think of themselves as Christians. Why? Because most people think of themselves as moral. Most people think of themselves as reasonably good people that don't do all the bad stuff, or at least don't do it to people who don't deserve it, and that they're reasonably moral people. And if Christianity equals morality and morality equals Christianity, then by definition they're Christians. My view is one of the pressing tasks for us in evangelism is two things. One, it's to distinguish between Christianity and morality. Where in the Bible is Christianity distinguished from moralism? Where is the great distinction drawn between Christianity and moralism? Who are the moralists in the New Testament? The Pharisees. Profoundly moral people. So whatever Jesus is doing in the Gospels, what he's doing is he is showing that moralism is not the same as Christianity, and Christianity is not the same as moralism. And so that is an urgent task for us, is to show how Christianity is different from moralism. Not that it's immoralism. That would be to fall into an either-or mistake, wouldn't it? The second thing that I think it would be really great if we learned better and better how to do was to work with where people are instead of telling them where they're not. To work with people where they are instead of telling them where they're not. And if we come out with a pretty hostile, pretty vigorous, you're not this and you're not that and you don't believe well enough and you should do this and you should do that and so on, then people will jack up and back off. But if it's true that 50% or thereabouts of the population believe all the Christian doctrine stuff, some portion of our job is already done for us. And yet we seem really challenged at being able to take that and move it forward instead of look at that and complain why it isn't further down the track. So that would be my suggestion, to say, fear God in the days of youth. Actually, they don't fear him, that's certainly true. But they do believe in him, on the whole, most people. And our task, I would suggest, is to do these two things, to move people forward rather than complain that they aren't forward, and secondly, to help them know that the gospel is not moralism. It's not just being a nice person. In fact, who's Jesus come to save? The sick, yes. That is you and me. And if we were able to talk about our ongoing need for grace today, the ways in which in my heart I've sinned today, the way that I've... And so this is why I tried to end that talk with. Ecclesiastes says, fear God and keep his commandments. And so let me take a quick poll. Who here this last week has perfectly feared God and kept his commandments? Because if you are one of those people, then you don't need Jesus. And he's got nothing to do with you. You see, actually, in the end, the fear God and keep his commandments is going to be something that we say, there's only one who's feared God and kept his commandments. It's him. And in particular, it's not me. So at that point, I'm with the unbeliever as we both look to Jesus. Because what distinguishes me from the unbeliever is not that I've feared God and kept his commandments, is it? Because neither of us have. He might have done it more overtly than me, but I still confess my sins this week. All I'm inviting him to do is join me in being a confessing sinner. When we can talk about grace like that, when we're really good at distinguishing grace from moralism, then I think that we'll be able to talk to unbelievers better about the gospel. Because at the moment, they won't listen to us, because all they think that we're telling them is that we're better people than they are and they should be like us. And they're saying, you can think if you're a better person than me, that's if you want, but hey. But we hear that and we go, no, that's not the message of Jesus Christ, is it? That I'm a better person than you and you should become like me? Let me try that again. That's not the message of Jesus Christ, is it? That I'm a better person than you and you should become like me?
No.
Thank you, Arthur. Actually, I'll just have one comment, if I may, which is we live in a very relational world now, it seems to me. And that what all the technology has done, interestingly enough, is put a premium on personal relationships. So my guess is, and this is just a guess, you know, we're all at one level, my guess is that the primary context for that education process to take place is the shopping together, the coffee shop, the conversation, the bowls, the sailing, the, in my case, the golf, the, you know, that is just, that's where I need. And actually, part of what I need to do is, and I say this as a minister, and I know this is a terrible thing for a minister to say, churches should do less to make sure that the people in the churches can do more with people who aren't in the churches. I didn't say that, and don't tell anyone I said it.
So this is a kind of amusing question for me. So I'll repeat the question and say why it's funny. So the question is, would you use Ecclesiastes as a topic for teaching, discussion with young people, teenagers, university students, and what was the response? I was a university student who heard Andrew lecture on Ecclesiastes, and so I got him here to talk about it.
and the answer is yes, actually. And I think I think this is right. The UCCF, the University what's it stand for in Britain? The equivalent of the Australian Fellowship of Evangelical Students in England, UCCF, I think it's called, published a version of Ecclesiastes, including kind of discussion questions, and in order to just give that out to students in a kind of, you know, modern, you know, jazzed up sort of binding and form, precisely because they thought that Ecclesiastes was the kind of thing that would do two things. It would challenge students' current views and maybe just prize them open a little bit to something else as a secondary, you know, a subsequent conversation. So I think Ecclesiastes has a great deal to say, not just to students, actually, but to anyone. And this is because, as I say, the great theme of Ecclesiastes is neither all nor nothing. And yet we do live in a very all or nothing kind of world. I was thinking about it in all sorts of contexts, in marriage, for example. People think that they're going to have a marriage, when they start out as married, they're going to have a marriage that's going to make, you know, When Harry Met Sally look like a sort of a dull black and white movie. You know, they're going to have the marriage to end all ages. It's just they're in love, or as we used to say, they're in love. They're just passionate. And then reality hits and kids, and you sort of move from that to, oh, well, we'll get by, or worse, we'll just leave and try again. All or nothing. Jobs. You start off in a career, and it's going to be, I'm going to change the world. And actually, the world proves remarkably resistant to your capacity to change it. And so what does job become? Job becomes, just get the nicest boat. You know, drive the nicest car. Just don't do anything with your job. Don't try and make any contribution. All or nothing. So I think there are heaps of people, not just students, but young workers, middle-aged people. The midlife crisis. Here's how to define a midlife crisis. The midlife crisis is that moment when you realise that whatever all you were shooting for is not going to happen. And therefore, the midlife crisis is the collapse from that recognition to nothing. And if you can grab people at that moment and say, no, it's not all, you're quite right about that. It's not nothing, therefore. Come on, read Ecclesiastes. Own this. And in Jesus Christ, here's one of the things that you can be sure about, even if you can't have all the answers to everything. So I think Ecclesiastes, particularly at our time, particularly in our culture, actually has a very great deal to contribute.
Got lots of stuff I'd like to kind of ask or say, but I'm going to hand it over because this is great. Yes, anyone else? Yes. So the question is, the churches that seem to be doing well are kind of seem to be embodying better the carpe diem, seize the day, dare I say young, looks wonderful, optimism, success, all that sort of stuff. Are we missing something?
As always, remember I said, whenever you think about something, ask who the pronoun refers to, who's the we. Partly it all depends on what doing well means. One of the really interesting questions that the National Church Life Survey asks is, were you a member of a church 5 years ago. Okay, so do you do the National Church Life Survey? Have you heard? So it's coming up in next year. Actually, 11 was the last one. 16's the one coming up. And the reason for asking that question is this. A lot of people are part of the church that they're currently part of by having moved from the church that they were previously part of. It's called shuffling the deck chairs. And if you want to be really nasty, you can say shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. But there you go. Or sheep stealing. Actually, there's all sorts of good reasons to move churches. Lots of people at the church where I serve, St. John's, used to go to another church in the Blue Mountains. And they've moved down from the Blue Mountains to Sydney. And they move into the inner west because that's the closest they can get to the city that they can still afford. And so they come along to church at Ashfield. And actually, the time of moving house like that, moving locality, is a classic time when people drop out of church going and eventually drop out of being part of Christ and confessing Christ. And so having someone transfer to church at the time of a relocation like that is a win. That's not somehow a loss. In my judgment, the measure of evangelistic fruitfulness is that there is a good, healthy percentage of people who are in the church who weren't in a church 5 years ago. And on that measure, I'm not sure that the mega churches are doing any better than any other church. And that the large churches, there are quite a number of them, as far as I can tell, have no better hit rate, if I can put it like that, at winning people to Christ. What they're especially good at doing is winning Christians to their church. Now, what do I think of that? I don't know. As long as they're going from some other church to their church, that's okay by me. I know that was a joke, which you didn't get. I said it too fast. And I think there's some upsides to that. I think there's some downsides to that. What I do know is that ministers like me can often complain about it because so I'm nervous about my own motives in complaining about it. You see what I'm saying? So my point here is just to challenge the question a little bit and to say they're doing better. And I'm saying, well, maybe they are and maybe they aren't. There's actually heaps of statistics that say that smaller churches grow by conversion growth at a greater rate than bigger churches. There's lots of statistics that say that. And so that there's plenty of church researchers out there that would much rather have 20 churches of 50 than one church of 1,000. And that 20 churches of 50 will win more people to Christ and see more depth of community and greater discipleship than one church of 1,000. So I rejoice in the churches of 1,000 and I rejoice in the churches of 50, and I just think it's a place for all of them everywhere, and I'll do what God has got for me to do. And if he wants to turn the church where I'm serving into a church of 1,000, then he'll probably need someone else to do it, and so we'll go find him. Or if he's got that we'll just stay where we are, then that's okay too, and I'm okay with that. And I think there are things to learn both ways.
I guess because after all, what you do is absurd, right?
Absolutely. And there are plenty of fruitless ministers that do well.
Sorry, anyone else? Yeah. I just wanted to share a slight anecdote. You were talking about before kind of going with the positives and being gracious and showing the distinction between Christianity and moralism. There's a professor at Sydney University who's pretty kooky sort of Christian, but he's absolutely brilliant. He's a Greek guy. He was on Q&A the other day. And he seems to have this ministry of converting academics, like students. And basically he does it by telling them, you're actually Christian, you don't know it. You have all these commitments, and here's where they come from. And that's the gospel. And this is what the gospel has done in our culture. And you value, like, what are you doing? Why don't you just wake up and, you know, smell the roses? Stop actually being inauthentic, because you're actually a Christian in all the commitments that you have. And Christianity has the reasons why you have those commitments. Which is really, I mean, I think he's got a lot of sort of social capital in terms of people come to his lectures. He's quite eccentric and charismatic, so they all like him. But that's how he does it. So it can work, even in a university. So. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. Look, I just want to say thank you to everyone for coming today. Thank you for participating in the forum. If you'd like to, the talks are going to be on our website sometime soon, stgeorgesbatterypoint.org. So if you want to sort of go over them or, you know, pass them on to somebody else if you really enjoyed the teaching today. And I have a couple other things here. Just to remind myself, if you have a look on the back of your brochure, there's some options for feedback. We'd love to hear if you've got any suggestions of things that we could do better or things that you enjoyed. We'd love to hear from you. And I think also we're going to need a little bit of help packing up afterwards, particularly if there's any blokes who'd be happy for moving chairs. John will be kind of directing that, so if you're able to stick around to help out with that, that would be good. The last thing I think I need to do is to thank Andrew, actually, for his ministry to us. I don't know about you, but I've been tremendously encouraged by this. I think Andrew has not only opened the Word of God for us so that we're drawn into it more deeply, seeing the riches of God's grace and his love for us and wisdom for life, living life well, but it's life in the world that we actually know. He's opened the world for us so that we can understand that better too and live well in the context we find ourselves. And so I've found that tremendously encouraging. I hope you have as well. And so I just want to say thank you, Andrew, for your ministry amongst us. And why don't we give Andrew a round of applause.